Hello everyone, welcome to this new episode of the Swift Academy podcast. Today I'm very happy to be with Natalia Penforava that come from New Zealand and we'll speak about a lot of things related to Swift UI, accessibility, the new liquid glass material design, and we finish with a great demo from the new application of Natalia, Brivi, or Brief, if you can say. Hello, Natalia, and how are you?
Hi, I'm good. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Natalia. Today, we will have a lot of topics to discuss, but maybe you have a little introduction about yourself. I know that you worked at Apple before. You have a lot of experience about Swift UI because you worked on the Apple Swift UI API, and maybe that you can make a little introduction about your journey as iOS and macOS developers, maybe your careers.
Sure, yeah. I've been a software developer for about 10 years probably now. I started with learning computational linguistics at first, and then I moved on to the web development, did a bit of React and Ruby on Rails, but just briefly for like a year and a bit. And then I started learning iOS and stayed in the iOS community for a long time. So yeah, when I started learning iOS, I was still UIKit, but Swift already. Okay. And then, yeah, that's the first setup I had. And then Swift UI came out. So I started experimenting with Swift UI, started my blog. It became quite popular and I got noticed by the Swift UI team at Apple. And they invited me to interview for an open role they had. So that's how I got the job on the Swift UI team. Yeah, and it was really great. I worked with really great people for a bit. And then I left Apple because they started inviting people back to the office and they wanted me to move to the US. But I just got my permanent residency in New Zealand. So I wanted to just stay here and get settled here. So I left Apple and started working on my own company on apps. I also worked in a New Zealand company for a bit, but now focusing back full time on my apps, my books, my blog, do a bit of contracting here and there.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Natalia. Okay. It was a great presentation about you for people that maybe didn't know about your profile or career, but I know that a lot of people know about your books, your blogs, Nilko Leasing, and other things that you did. Okay. Maybe we can start with the first thing that came from the WWDC, maybe a game changer for some people, liquid glass, the new material liquid glass. And my first question, this is something that a lot of fear from things that that a lot of developers are thinking about adopting and talking about this new liquid glass design in iOS 26. From your point of view, how it's easy to adopt this new design, especially in great application with a lot of customers? What kind of strategy that we can do?
I think it really depends on the kind of the app and how it's structured and whether it uses a lot of standard components or a lot of custom components. Because if the basic components like navigation, tab view, toolbars are standard components, either built with Swift UI or with UIKit, they will automatically become liquid glass components as soon as you rebuild with the new Xcode. That between the new iOS version, so there should be almost no issues there. But of course, if you're using fully custom UI, fully custom navigation layer, then you will have more work either looking whether you can start adopting the standard components and get the liquid glass UI for free, or how you can build your own custom liquid glass component.
And in our company, when Apple started to think about iOS 26, there is a lot of fear about that, because we have a lot of customer component, maybe in something related to navigation, tab bar, etc. And there is a lot of question how we can adopt the new liquid glass in iOS 26 and also in other versions that are iOS 18, 17, etc. Because generally, big company, generally minus two versions about the last version of. And we have a lot of discussion in our teams about maybe we will make, if iOS 26 we do things, else we do another things. There is some confusion about how liquid glass should and shouldn't be used. And as I said, in our teams, there is a lot of confusion about maybe we need to make if condition our code to adopt the liquid glass in iOS 26. And we keep our code the same for the other versions. What do you think about that?
Yeah, there's definitely different strategies that are possible. I think firstly, it might be a good time to work with your designers and figure out if you can move to using some standard components like toolbars, navigation bars, tab bars. I think that would be the easiest way forward if you can, because then you don't need to have any if else. They will automatically be liquid glass for iOS 26, the older version of the UI for all the versions. So if you can gradually move to using the standard components just for the navigation layer, I think that would be the easiest part.
Yes.
If not, then yes, I'm afraid you'll have to build separately the components for iOS 26 and keep your older components and have a version switch in code. Like, we have one of our apps which is fully custom UI, and we have that switch checking on the version, like right in the root view. So one branch goes to iOS 26 UI and one branch goes to the old UI.
And I think it's a question of strategy, like you said. And sometimes developers don't have this ability to discuss with the design teams, with the product, about the choice. They come to say, we need that you support all the version of the iOS with specificity for iOS 26 and also for the other versions. And some company didn't have any design systems sometimes. And, you know, all the legacy code that will be changed due to this change of material, the liquid glass. And that comes to my another question from people that love building some custom UI. And this custom UI, it's specifically for some company to have some custom UI. And what is your advising to for balancing this kind of custom UI and the new liquid glass? What kind of strategy that developers can have to have the custom UI component and adopt also the new liquid glass?
So during WWDC and then later in the events that Apple had, where they reiterated on what was introduced, they said that it's best to only use liquid glass in the navigation layer, so the layer that sits on top of the UI, and not to use liquid glass in scroll views, because what should be avoided is overlapping liquid glass components. So if you put liquid glass in scroll views and then they scroll underneath the glass toolbar or tab bar, then you'll have overlapping glass effect, which should be avoided. So it's best to, if you are building custom liquid glass components, to put them in a navigation layer or like the toolbar layer. So the layer that sits on top of your main content view, that would be the place to put it. And then you can put more color and more custom UI in the content layer that scrolls. Just probably don't use liquid glass there.
But I noticed also that there is some component like Switch, like research that have changed the behavior of this component changing. And it will impact a lot of applications, this change in the behavior. We have the search in the bottom. We have the switch that changes. Some custom UI are based of this kind of component that are impacted with the new liquid glass. Maybe that's why Apple gives some time for developers, I think, to Xcode 27 to September to make changes in the to adapt their application to support the new liquid glass. And didn't like the new liquid glass. They think that there is big buttons with big cancel buttons, big buttons also. And they think that the behavior is strange because from their point of view, Apple, it will be continue with this liquid glass, but also it will just for this version, and they try to check what people think about this version and maybe to come back to the old material design before liquid glass. What do you think about that? If liquid glass, you are sure that it will be the next generation of material design for Apple, especially for iOS, because people like it in macOS, the liquid glass, but there is some A lot of developers and also customers, people that use iPhone, didn't like the new Liquid Glass. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I don't think they will completely revert to the previous UI, but I do think there is quite a bit more tweaking to do, and I hope they will be working on that. Overall, I quite like the look of it. I think it looks really modern and delightful, but I do think there is maybe some changes that need to be done, and it should be a little bit more polished, and I hope that's what's going to happen over the next few releases. I noticed that some Liquid Glass components just don't respond to touches how it is. I would expect them to respond. Like sometimes you have to tap multiple times, or sometimes they don't quite adapt to light and dark properly. Like I noticed some issues there, or sometimes the buttons in the tab view are not visible against the background. So I think there could be more automatic behavior where they go white or black, depending if they're on top of a colorful background or not. And I hope that Apple will be looking into those things and making it better.
Yes. Okay. And I understand it will be make some little changes, adapted things that will be more aesthetic, if we can say it, in the iOS, in the new Liquid Glass. Okay, great. That comes to the second part of our discussions about new things in SwiftUI, because when we have Liquid Glass, we have new API that comes to help developers to do things in the Liquid Glass. And people think that there is no big change that come in WWDC 25 about SwiftUI. But for your point of view, what are the big changes, the new API that come and that maybe need that we try to watch the video about this new API and integrate it in our application?
I think overall, it probably wasn't such a big SwiftUI release as we're used to, because I imagine the whole team was focusing on supporting Liquid Glass. But we did get a couple of big updates, like the WebView, SwiftUI WebView, and the rich text editor in SwiftUI, which I think are worth looking into, and they could potentially reduce the dependence of many apps on UIKit, because we had to integrate with UIKit for those components before. I haven't used either of them myself yet, just because I haven't worked on apps that needed them yet. But I'm excited to try the rich text editor functionality soon.
Okay, great. Let's come to another question about, it's usually the same question for people that work on SwiftUI. If SwiftUI can replace now fully the UIKit, because we are not agnostic now from UIKit. We need some API from UIKit. Some people use for navigation. In our application, we didn't use the navigation from SwiftUI. We think that it's not cover all the, our issue in our application, because it's a great application. That's why we need some navigation based on UIKit. And there is other things, like you said, from the web view in SwiftUI. And now, hopefully, that can fix all the issues in SwiftUI, but there is other company that use it for now, WebKit from UIKit, and because there is no API from SwiftUI. Can we say that SwiftUI now it's mature, if we can say it, and can fully replace UIKit?
I think it really depends on the app and the functionality the app needs to provide. In my new app, I didn't use UIKit at all.
Okay.
But in many of my other apps, I do use it, especially if I need any text editing functionality. I usually use either UI TextView or NS TextView if it's for the macOS, just because I think SwiftUI doesn't quite provide all the text editing functionality that I need and all the flexibility that comes with those views. Yeah, like you mentioned, if you need some complex navigation, maybe you can achieve it with SwiftUI, maybe you can't. Or maybe you just have such a big app and it doesn't make sense to rewrite it all in SwiftUI. And if it works and you like it, why touch it, you know? Keep it working and maybe just add new functionality in SwiftUI if it's the way to go.
Yes, it depends on the application. And also it takes time to refactor things from UIKit to SwiftUI. And sometimes there is a lack of budgets to do that. And the risk and people, okay, we keep that in UIKit because we are not confident that in SwiftUI we didn't have, there is no, from, especially for company that have minimum like kind of iOS 16, which come with a lot of problems in SwiftUI, especially for animation, something like that. And people, okay, we keep in UIKit in time that we move to minimum version of iOS 18, 2 years or in 1 year. And it depends of the company, of the strategy, of the code that exists, and from decision, if you can say it. That's come to another question from my side about what we call the pitfalls that you discover when you see developers coding on Swift UI. There is a lot of strategy. There is a lot of, from my side, I like really creating what we call custom modifiers. And people think, oh, it's over-engineering because we have this kind we can do with simple API. And there is a lot, because until now, I think that we'd have this kind of guide and the best practice. Maybe in your book, you have a lot of things to advise developers about what kinds of good things, what good practice that developers should adopt in when decoding on Swift UI. Because I think that people code in Swift UI in the same manner like UI kits. They didn't understand the paradigm about Swift UI, and they think, okay, it's a new API that give us to create component, but the declarative paradigm behind this, it's not clear for all the developers. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think I noticed a similar thing, that it's harder for experienced UI kit developers to switch to Swift UI, and they still think of Swift UI views in terms, like in the same way they think of UIKit views, even though they're completely different things. Like UIKit views are classes, they stay in memory while the view is presented, while SwiftUI views are structs and they're just used to create the description of the UI. They don't stick around. SwiftUI just creates them and discards them straight away as soon as the graph is constructed, the data structure that is actually responsible for the relationships of all the components and figuring out what changed and what needs to be rendered. So I see a lot of developers building really big SwiftUI views with really large view bodies, and they think that splitting them into smaller views will create performance overhead, even though that's it's not right, because SwiftUI views are really lightweight. So as long as you don't put any heavy logic in the initializer of the view, it will be very fast to create those views. So never hesitate to split your massive view bodies into smaller views. It will be more composable, more reusable, more maintainable. And it actually can improve the performance, because it's easier for SwiftUI to understand what bodies need to be called when state changes, if they're separate views. Because if you have a really large view and something changes, the entire body will be called, the entire large body. While if you have smaller views with smaller bodies, only the ones that depended on that state that changed will be recalled. Mm. So yeah, it's really important to split things up into smaller components. And you mentioned custom modifiers. Yes, that's a great strategy as well. You can create view extensions or you can create custom modifiers. And we even notice that sometimes, especially when working with a map, like SwiftUI map, it's better to split almost all the logic into custom modifiers. Otherwise, there will be some issues, views won't render properly. So yeah, never hesitate to split everything up.
Okay. And also, I read a lot of developers speaking about what we call the diffing system that SwiftUI adapt to calculate things. And do you think that you need to understand this kind of diffing system when you try to code, or something that it's not important? Keep in your mind that you need to write small view using SwiftUI, and it's sufficient to have a great code. What do you think about that, to understand this kind of how SwiftUI work under the hood, and something it's important from your point of view to understand that, or something it's over?
I think it's important. Probably not if you're just a beginner learning SwiftUI. Probably not so much. Just create smaller views. Don't put heavy logic in the initializers. Use observable instead of observable object, and you should be okay. But I think it's still good to understand why views get updated. For later, when you have issues, you will know why you have those issues and how to solve them. Definitely. It's not that complicated. You just have to understand that if the state changes, if the view body reads that state, it will get reevaluated. If the view body gets reevaluated, it doesn't mean that the UI gets recreated.
Yes.
The UI, the user sees on screen. SwiftUI has internal logic to understand what needs to actually be recreated. So don't worry, even if your view body gets called, it's still okay. SwiftUI is just using it to figure out if something changed and if something needs to be rendered on the UI level.
Maybe it's a good opportunity to speak about your book, Fundamentals about SwiftUI. Speak about this kind of things, about adopting a specially standard component, and maybe you can speak about your books. It's an opportunity to speak about
yeah.
that. No problem.
Of course. Thank you. So yeah, I've been observing how developers use SwiftUI, and I thought that many developers struggle to understand how it works under the hood on the slightly deeper level, because the tutorials, the Apple tutorials, the WWDC videos, they don't always present this information in a structured way, or they don't go deep enough. So I thought it would be good to have a resource that is straight to the point, simple and structured enough, but also looks at the SwiftUI slightly deeper level, just to understand how it behaves and why it behaves this way, and how you can use it effectively so you don't end up biting the framework, but working with it instead. So I wrote my book, SwiftUI Fundamentals. I released this year, and I went into as much detail as possible of the inner workings of SwiftUI to the level that I can share, as I'm allowed to share as an ex-Apple employee. But it should be good enough for anyone working with SwiftUI to get a good understanding of how the framework works.
Okay, great. Thank you. I think that we finish with the new SwiftUI API, things that comes with iOS 26, to come to the third part of our discussion about accessibility. There is a lot of talk, books, especially in the UX community. And now in France, we have a lot of application. We need to improve accessibility. There is a lot of recommendation from Apple about accessibility. And really, really, the subject is very, very important. And there is a huge changes if we go with accessibility, because that transform of a lot of our UI code and how we create our component, etc. Because accessibility related to the graphical and to the workflow of the application, and really, really very, 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 very big challenge for developers. And I think that what are, from your point of view, the significant updates that developers should have when they try to go with the accessibility, this challenge of accessibility, especially with legacy code. Because from my point of view, the difficult thing that we come with the application with thousands of line of codes that didn't support accessibility, and you say, okay, we need to add accessibility now. We can't. We need maybe to redevelop the application. If you try to support full accessibility, that for me the very difficult things, and for a lot of teams, that you come to an application that didn't support accessibility, and people said, okay, we need to support voiceovers. Okay, voiceovers, but how we can handle it, our components, our stack view, scroll view, etc. All the things about accessibility is related of how we structure our design. What do you think, Nadia?
I think it's good to just define the core flows in your app, like the core functionality, and start there. And yet, choose one, maybe accessibility functionality. For example, this month, we are focusing on supporting voiceover in our core workflows, and start there and make sure a user actually using voiceover can use the application and complete this core workflow as smoothly as you can. But you can always improve it later, because you have to start somewhere. It doesn't have to be perfect straight away. And next month, maybe you focus on a different workflow or a different accessibility functionality, like dynamic type or reduced motion. And yeah, that's, I think, the way to go, just gradually getting there, choosing the main parts of your application, improving them, then going to other parts, then coming back, iterating again, because it's a really big task. And I think it's difficult for many people, because it's not how we use our apps. So that's difficult to understand if it's good enough, the support we provide. So I think it's important to listen to user feedback, find maybe some beta testers who use some of this accessibility functionality to test your apps, so yes, we can collect as much feedback as possible.
Okay.
And I think it's worth mentioning here that this year there's a new section in the App Store where apps can provide accessibility nutrition labels. And I think it's also a good way to see how to approach accessibility testing. So you can pick one nutrition label, like larger text or reduced motion or reduced transparency.
Okay.
I'm not sure if it's one of them, but I think there's voice control, voiceover. There are quite a few of them. So I think looking at the accessibility support this way, in terms of different types of these labels can help us to figure out what we need to test exactly and what we need to support. Yes, and then we can also advertise it on the expert page that our app supports voiceover or voice control or larger text.
Great, thank you. Let's come. What kind of support you like to test accessibility? I think that Apple offers some tools to simulate, to check the accessibility using Xcode. But what do you think about how we can really test our support for accessibility? What is the best choice for developers?
So during development, I usually use this environment overrides in Xcode. I think it's really quick and helpful way to quickly check if the screen adapts the dynamic type properly or like dark and even dark and light mode or other accessibility settings. But I think the best way to test it is to still run it on a real device and update those settings in the settings app and really use your app how a user with this setting would use it. Just see, can you actually complete that workflow with that setting on?
Okay, I understand. You encourage to use the real device to check the accessibility and also to use other tools from Apple to check the dark mode, the light mode. I think related to VoiceOver that we can use using Xcode. And it's for your point of view, it's sufficient to check, to test the accessibility in the application. And I think that maybe you respond to me about that, but maybe about this last question. How much of work is required to support the accessibility from your point of view, especially in legacy application? Because as you know, business come with a budget and they said, okay, we need to, for example, 50% of accessibility. And please give us estimation, macro estimation about that. I know that's a very difficult question, but that's come to a lot of companies, especially in Europe. They have this attitude to fix the budget, etc. And they said to the technical leader, how much of time you have to, I know that's very, very strange question, but this is the reality because they have this kind of, they need to have estimation, macro estimation. From your point of view, for example, to an application like, if you can say it, Airbnb, I think that supports accessibility, but from this kind of application, what time, kind of work do you need to make the transformation? 1 year, 2 years? Depends. What do you think about that?
It depends. If it's in UI kit, it's going to take longer. So we need to know the percentage of code that's in UI kit versus Swift UI, because Swift UI provides a lot for free, while in UI kit you have to do more work. Depends on how many custom components there are, because again, if you're using custom system components, most of it will probably come for free. If you're using custom components, you have to do quite a bit of work to make them accessible. Probably think about the time you would need to implement those components and maybe give about half of the time estimate to make them accessible, I'd say.
Yes.
That would probably be about right.
Okay. It depends of the code. Of if you have native Swift UI component with really you think about good practice, you don't need a lot of time to adjust. Also, it depends if your application, sometimes you have what we call the multi-platform application that support iOS, iPadOS, macOS, especially with Swift UI. Maybe they need sometimes to adopt accessibility and it depends. It depends of the application. But you are okay with me that this kind of micro estimation is not it's not a good.
It's difficult to be accurate. Yes, yeah.
because people that come with this kind of micro estimation didn't know about how things work and how people code. Sometimes we need to make a lot of changes in your code. Okay. Let's come from the demo part, and I know that you have you did a great work in your application, Brivi, if we can say it, the application, and you will share with us some part of the code and also the application, and we'll speak about accessibility, Liquid class, and how you can in your application, which is application now in the App Store that support, I think, and iPadOS. Fix me if I said something a mistake. That's if you can share about the application and your project, please.
Let me share my screen.
Okay.
Can you see it?
Yes.
Great. So maybe I can do a very quick walkthrough of the app I built. So it's called Breve, and it's an app about coffee recipes. So it just includes a large collection of different coffee recipes or
yes.
different tastes. The recipes adapt to the equipment you have. So for example, if you brew your espresso at home with a semi-automatic machine, then presents you the instructions for that. You can switch to a different equipment type. For example, if you just have a mocha pot, you can choose that. And here it will adapt to the mocha pot instructions. You can learn how to froth your milk with different tools as well. Even if you want to experiment with latte art, it has tutorials for that too. So it's just an application for people who like to make coffee drinks at home. Yeah. And I wanted to build something for iOS 26 specifically, where I can experiment with the new APIs and with new liquid glass design. And I thought this idea would be great because it can be very colorful. So it can actually make those liquid glass components stand out on top of this very colorful UI. So I thought it was a good app to play around with for iOS 26. I didn't build many custom liquid glass components here. I mostly used the standard tab view at the bottom with the new liquid glass search, which is a separate tab. I used this liquid glass sheet in settings, yes, with this transform animation from the toolbar. But I did have to build one custom liquid glass component because I have timers. And in the first version of the app, I used the tab view bottom accessory for that. But unfortunately, it broke in the next beta, and it was too risky for me to wait longer to see if it gets fixed or not. So I just built my own custom components, which seems to be more reliable now. So it's, I can show it to you. Just have to find, or we have to switch to a different method. So I can start a timer.
Yes,
and it sits please. Like this on top of the tab bar. So I thought it was a good component to use liquid glass for, because it's not in the content layer. It sits on top of it. So kind of stuck to the tab view. This way, the timer is always visible because it's the probably primary thing you care about if it's running. And you can navigate throughout the app and it stays there. And it's a custom component that I put in a bottom safe area bar.
Okay.
And then tweaks like this when it's done. So yeah, I can show you some code of how this component works. So I have this timer bar view modifier.
Okay.
It has a bit of complicated logic, but it's mostly written lots of environment values and adapting to them. This is placed in the safe area bar edge bottom. And if there is an active timer, it creates a timer view. But depending on the size class, it has slightly different look. So on iPad, it goes to one side, so it doesn't take the entire bottom area of the screen. But on iPhone, it just sticks to the tab bar on top of the tab bar. So you can see it reads, for example, reduced transparency setting. Okay. Because I use the, let me show how the glass actually comes here. So I use glass effect regular interactive on the whole view. So that what gives it this glassy look. And this effect actually already adapts automatically to reduce transparency, but it strangely changes color sometimes in dark and light. And sometimes on scroll, it changes color to dark or light, where it doesn't really make sense to change color. So without reduced transparency, I do a bit of hack where I set the color scheme. I read the color scheme from the environment here, and I force it to be the actual light or dark, depending on the user setting. But in reduced transparency, I set it to always light because I can show you how it actually works with reduced transparency maybe. So I go to settings on my phone. I turn reduced transparency on. I come back to my app. And you can see the tab view becomes white by default. That's the standard adaptation. So that's no custom logic there.
Okay.
That's why even in dark mode, I had to force my timer view to be light. Otherwise, it looked really strange. So on top of the tab view. So that's a small adaptation I had to do. But yes, this is how the app looks in reduced transparency, because there should be no blurs. Yes, there should be no blurs. So that's a top effect that you can see the solid color bar that comes for free as well, just because I use the system toolbar, the top.
Okay, great.
So this is the reduced transparency. It also adapts to reduced motion, like it wiggles. For people who don't have that setting on, but so this is how it tested. go here. Neighbor reduced motion, come back here, set the timer. So it will not wiggle if the reduced motion setting is on. Let me find the view if I can. You can see my slightly messy code.
Okay, so.
So yeah, this just reading the reduced motion setting from the environment.
Great, the using of environment, of environments that help us.
Yeah, so here it goes off, says ready, but it doesn't wiggle, just says ready.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so and I set this phase animator if the reduced motion is not enabled, otherwise I just have the timer view without any wiggle. Mm. So that's the way to adapt to that. Most of the standard interactions like slide view, like sliding navigation, pushes will adapt automatically if you set reduced motion on, prefer crossfade transitions on. So if you're using standard navigation, you can see how it doesn't slide anymore. So that's automatic behavior. I didn't have to do anything for that.
Great.
The more standard components you use, the less work you will have to do to support different accessibility settings. Another setting that I have here is for dynamic type. So I just set it on my lock screen so I can quickly adjust the text here.
Oh, okay, great.
Oh, yes. And here the adapts. So again, I use standard fonts.
Okay.
So they adapt automatically. Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Don't set a fixed size on your fonts. Otherwise, you will have to do quite a bit of custom logic to support different text sizes.
Mm.
So just use standard like body, headline, title.
Okay. Not fixed with number like 14, 18, something like that, because when you try to support dynamic types, it will be, you have a problem with it at this point.
Yeah, for sure. Then you have just to do more work to make it work.
And when you speak about with the UX design, they should have this kind of culture about the guidelines when you try to support this, because if they insist to use some fix value of for font size, something like that, not use the standards used by Apple, will be with the spaghetti code to support that. Okay.
Yes, for sure. Yeah. So I think it's important to have designs and think how they would adapt to dynamic type, to larger text sizes, because some designs might need to change at least slightly. Mm. For example, my timer. It has two lines. It has the countdown and the step name, but if I go into the largest size, it just has the countdown. Because there is not enough screen space to show all of it.
Yes.
So maybe the design has to adapt a little bit. So I think it's good. It's a good thing to discuss with your designers to see what...
Yes, it's very important to discuss with them. And for voiceover, maybe. For testing voiceover in your application.
Sure. I have this little trick that I think it's very helpful to test, because I try using my app with VoiceOver and see if it even works and if I can navigate easily. And it can be difficult to navigate to the settings, enable VoiceOver, then navigate out of settings, especially for someone like me who doesn't usually use my phone with VoiceOver.
Okay.
So there is this trick where you can go to, have to go to accessibility.
Yes.
Accessibility shortcut here. It is at the bottom. And here you can choose which accessibility setting to enable when you triple tap on your side button. So I choose VoiceOver. Okay. And now I can just go to my app, for example, focus on the screen. Then I can triple tap the sidebar.
Oh, okay.
And it enables VoiceOver. So I can easily test it this way without having to go to settings every time. So I can just stay in the screen and quickly test it, see
Great
and navigate choice. Correctly.
And you can see...
Yeah.
Listen to the voiceover.
Yeah. And you can just see, does it navigate the way you want it to? Does it focus on the right elements? Is it in the right order? For example, for my ingredients, I had to do a bit of custom logic for my ingredients grid. So I have this accessibility representation, which is just a vista instead of a grid, so that when the user navigates voiceover, they focus on the entire line, not just 18 grams and then separately, finally ground coffee beans. It just will read 18 grams, finely ground coffee beans as one line. So I use accessibility representation here and accessibility element children combine with what makes it into a single element. And for my steps, I had to do some, for the recipe steps, I had to do some custom ordering as well, because I have these step actions, I call them, which is either a popover with ingredients or a timer. And the way they are positioned in the UI, by default, VoiceOver would navigate to the button first and then to the step, which doesn't really make sense, because you first want to hear the step, fill the water filter, remove the warm water filter, and then only see the ingredients you have to put in it. So the button have to come logically after the step description. I adjusted the order with this accessibility sort priority.
Okay.
So the highest number will be read first. So the step title will be read first, then the step description,
yes.
And then
control with the priority.
The button. Yes. And then to make sure that it's affecting just this particular component, I use accessibility element children contain in this case.
Contain.
So they're still separate elements, but in one logical setup.
Okay. Great.
Yeah.
Great.
These are the adjustments I had to do.
Yes. Yes. Thank you. And what kind of plane to expand your accessibility? Things that you need to add in the application for the version that comes maybe in the future?
I need to keep testing the app with other accessibility settings. I haven't really had time to test it yet with voice control. I assume it should be all right because I already have this other support for a voiceover, but I still have to test it properly before I put on the app store that it supports voice control. And as I use it more and more every time I test it with a voiceover, I notice a few things that could be improved. For example, when I set a timer, it doesn't get announced that it's now running. When I show a sheet, it doesn't focus on the title straight away. When I dismiss a sheet, it doesn't go to the step of the recipe from which the sheet was presented. It goes to the top of the recipe. So these are things, they are still usable, but it's not amazing. It's not like perfect. It's not as smooth as it could be. So these are the things I would like to adjust in the future. And I think it's all about iterating and just doing our best and improving step by step.
Yes, great. Thank you. Thank you for this presentation. A lot of things that you shared, Natalia. And we come to the end of our episode. And maybe you have something to say in the end of this episode. Hope that you find the discussion very intuitive from your side. And we try to cover a lot of things in this episode. And hopefully that people enjoy this episode.
Yes, thank you so much for having me. It was a great pleasure to talk to you, to talk about SwiftUI, about liquid glass accessibility. These are all the topics I'm really passionate about. And I really like sharing what I learn while trying new things and learning new APIs, new ways to use them.
Yes, hopefully from next version of your books, that we maybe will integrate things related to liquid glass and something like that. We will share the links to all your books in the description of the video, this episode. We'll find this also in the website of Natalia, Neil Colizing. It's a famous website about SwiftUI best practices and everything related to Apple development using Swift. Thank you, Natalia, and see you soon. Thank you.
Thank you.